Welcome to the Collective Impact Forum podcast, here to share resources to support social change makers working on cross-sector collaboration. In this episode, we're sharing a keynote talk titled Moving from Charity to Justice in Collective Impact by Liz Dozier, founder and CEO of Chicago Beyond, an impact investor that backs the fight for youth equity. Chicago Beyond exists so that all youth, especially the most vulnerable, will have the opportunity to achieve their fullest human potential. Since its launch in 2016, Chicago Beyond has invested more than $30 million in disruptive organizations, ideas, and people to make that a reality. Liz Dozier has spent her career working tirelessly to disrupt the culture of inequity that is often pervasive in education. Before launching Chicago Beyond, Liz was a teacher and a principal. She says that is where she has learned some of her greatest life lessons. This talk was held on May 16th, 2019, at the 2019 Collective Impact Convening in Chicago.
Okay, so good morning, everyone. That's good. Try it again. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
All right. You know, I'm a teacher and a principal, so we've got to get that nice, good morning to get us started. So great to be able to join this room today and to be able to be here with you. So thank you for being here. I always worry every time I speak that, like, no one's going to show up, so I'm glad you're here. I also, before I get started, just want to thank my team. If the folks from Chicago Beyond, if you could just stand up, the Chicago Beyond team, where are you guys at? And of course, there they are. They're in the black and white shirts. I truly believe, and I think this room especially knows this, that no one person does anything by themselves. It is always a collective of people that moves a body of work or an idea or a movement forward. And my team has been just, I mean, absolutely incredible. I could spend the next 71 minutes and 8 seconds talking about them alone, but alas, I will not. But just a special shout out to the Chicago Beyond team. Everyone has contributed to what you're about to hear today. So thank you to them. So I'm going to start by just saying that all of us in this room are actors. Now, it might be a little shocking because when we think of it, it's not the kind that we usually think about. We're not those type of actors. We're not this guy right there, right? We're not him. And I'm definitely not that gal over there. But nonetheless, all of us in this room are truly actors. We're all here to achieve collective impact, which this forum defines. I'm gonna show it up here so you can see it. Defines it as this, and I'll just read it to you. The commitment of a group of actors from different sectors to a common agenda for solving a complex social problem. Now, we all know the term collective impact has been around roughly since about 2011 is when we first hear it really come on the scene within our space. And the fact is that over this time, and really through generations, we've always had this group of committed actors from different sectors trying to solve really complex social problems. Nevertheless, here we are, we're sitting in this room, and we're confronting some of the same societal issues that have plagued our country since its founding. And so I ask you, my fellow actors in this work together, if we are so good, if we're so good at what we do, why the heck are we still in business? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's how I felt when I wrote it too. We're gonna have some fun today. So, of course, there's an underlying reason for the problem in our society, and that's the fact that there is an undeniable power imbalance, which is undergirded by the things we all know. It's everything from sexism to racism to wealth disparity, and the list goes on. And under these systems, we have a relatively small number at the top who hold the power, a disproportionate amount of power over the people, the many who are at the bottom. And American philanthropy, I would argue, is no different. There's a power imbalance there as well. And just as that power imbalance gets in the way of our society functioning fairly and effectively, so too does it get in the way of American philanthropy functioning fairly and effectively. And I believe, in my opinion, some of this can actually be traced back to the word that is all too often synonymously used with philanthropy. And that single word is charity. Now, this is a lovely word. It's a lovely word. And certainly, I would argue, and I think a lot of you in here would too, there's a lot of good that's resulted from charity and from kind of the countless acts of charity that people have done for hundreds of years. But charity is also a word that is laden with power. It is something that people who are in power do for those people without power. And this top-down good intentions with a distribution of dollars is essentially how philanthropy has always worked. And judging by the results, it has yielded a lot of convenings. We've gotten a lot of round tables. We've gotten some Stanford Social Innovation articles, some luncheons. We've gotten the all too ever familiar evening gala benefits. But this hasn't been enough to create the lasting impact that all of us, and I argue it's every single person in this room, regardless of where you come from across this country, whether it's a small town, a big town, no matter who you're serving, we haven't gotten the lasting impact that we're searching for. We're still in business. So the question in my mind is, how do we do things better? How can we do better? How can we actors, everyone in this room, solve complex social problems more effectively? And in searching for an answer, I think Ms. K really demonstrates. I think of her. So Ms. K is a person, a woman who volunteers with one of our partner agencies, a partner nonprofit. She lives in one of the communities that Chicago Beyond serves, and she's someone who just kind of scrapes by, right? She's not independently wealthy. But when there was a coat drive recently, and for those of you who know Chicago winters, you know Chicago winter is no joke, especially not this last winter where there was a polar vortex. It's no joke. And so there was a coat drive, and Miss K went out and she purchased a coat for a child. And on weekends, she regularly cooks meals for young people who are in her community so that they can be fed over the weekends when they don't have their regular school lunch. And I believe that what Ms. K is doing is different from charity. There are no accolades there. Her act doesn't seek to reinforce the power to influence others. She doesn't have power in the conventional sense, really. She wasn't donating some disposable income so you get a nice, like, tax deduction. Ms. K doesn't even really have enough to itemize on her taxes. She's not tithing to help some random poor person in some far-off place. Ms. K is directly serving. She's directly supporting her neighbors, the people she looks at every single day, face-to-face. It's the ones she sees. I would argue, no, she's not performing acts of charity. She's performing acts of justice. And justice is always doing the right thing, even though it might cost you something, even though you might be losing out, even though you might have to give up something of yours. Now, I realize this act of justice has become something of a fashionable word. I mean, I think we can all agree on that. And also in fashion of late is the word equity and the word woke. We've all heard this. Sometimes, you know, you're in meetings, you feel like people are having like this woke off thing, like who's the more woke person, which is very, very strange for those of us who have been in the work for a while. But this is why I keep Ms. K in mind. It's so that we don't let these words like justice, that we don't let these words like equity and the like become just jargon, some watered down versions of what they were truly meant to be. We in this room must keep these concepts as the real as the work that Ms. K does every single day. And after that other word that I talked about, the word charity, there is, of course, much about it that's admirable. But I would argue that it's also highly problematic. It reinforces these power imbalances that are created for the need for the acts of charity in the first place. And it can oftentimes demean the recipients, even though it's unintended. And it draws the line so starkly between the haves and the have-nots. It celebrates the actors who do the giving, rather than the relationships, the healing, or actually even more than the end results. To paraphrase Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he says, charity does a great job of helping us all to forget why it is needed. By contrast, justice is inherently about leveling the playing field. It elevates all of us as human beings, and it pays attention to the means and to the end, and it underscores what should be the true purpose of philanthropy, which is not charity, but it is in achieving a just world. And that's what Ms. K does. And if she can do it, so can each of us in this room. Now, I understand this authentic movement from charity to justice is a major change for the social change world. And it's a fundamentally different way of showing up. It's a fundamentally different way of relating to people and of talking about the work. And there's a fundamental shift in how we think. But we live in the area of big changes in which the fundamental understandings of physics and biology and ecosystems are changing before our very eyes. Just think about it, over the last even 10 years. It's our ability as we think about what's happening in our world, how things began to shift. We pride ourselves in our country and really across the world of reimagining entire industries. I mean, just step back and think about perhaps where you were even 10, 15, 20 years ago, what the world looked like. Just think about Amazon. Just think about Apple. Think about Airbnb, Netflix. I mean, it's just incredible, even Uber. And time again, if someone is willing to reframe a problem, incredible change can follow from that. So after I left being a principal about 3 years or so ago, I founded Chicago Beyond, which is actually in 2016, as something of a test concept to really think about how shifting from charity to justice, making that shift, could work in the real world. And anyone who lives in Chicago and knows Chicago, Chicago is definitely the real world for a variety of reasons. But to fully understand Chicago Beyond's journey, I wanted to just take a step back. And I want you to know a little bit about my own journey. So we're going to pop a visual up on the screen really quick. And this woman that you see on your left has a lot to do with shaping who I am. As you can see, she's a Catholic nun. But there is probably the not so obvious part about why she shaped my journey. She's my mother. Ooh. It's about to get real. So I'll let that sink in for a minute. Okay, so here's how that, we're gonna digress a little bit. So here's how that went down. So like, here's how it all gets started. So like the good nun she was, my mom ministered to men in prison, and that's where she met my dad. And you could just say that things went a little bit off script. And after 20 years, my mom decides to leave the convent. She eventually marries my dad when he gets out of jail. And years later, they eventually wound up getting divorced. But my mom was a single mom. I grew up in a single parent home for the majority of my years. And money in our household was really tight. My mom, as you can imagine, really believed in Catholic education. It's where she, you know, prided herself as a Catholic school teacher when she was a nun. And she really wanted to give that same quality of education to myself and my sister. And she was determined from kindergarten to our senior year of high school, we were going to Catholic school. Now, she still remained a Catholic school teacher at a different school in another part of the city. But if you know anything about Catholic school teachers, they don't make the most money, okay? They just don't. And so to be able to afford a Catholic school education for us, my mom often worked summers at Burger King. She was a motel maid at Motel 8, which was right over in Crestwood where we lived. She took odds and ends job. She worked at this place where they do like bingo on the weekends. She would, you know, serve drinks and all that type of stuff. But she never complained. My mom was never a big complainer. She never asked for any accolades. She was never really acting like she was doing anything out of the norm. I actually texted her last night. I told her I was going to talk about her. And I think I always appreciated my mom. As I was writing this and thinking about you guys, I realized, you know, my mom, I wouldn't be standing on this stage if not for my mom. My mom also brought her strict convent training to our home. So let me just tell you, if you've been raised by a nun, you know strict, okay? I was raised with a very firm structure. There were rules, and if you erred, there was a consequence. It's just how nuns are. They can't help it. It's just how they are. So my sister and I, we spent our formative years really in this structured home environment. We were really well cared for. We had all the basic things that people need. But let me tell you, we didn't grow up with any power, and we didn't grow up with any privilege. And then I went on to college, and where I experienced what you might say is the ultimate sense of powerlessness. You see, one night I was actually sexually assaulted, and objectively, I knew that I hadn't done anything wrong. But that's not what my feelings were telling me. I felt guilty, and I felt isolated, and I felt vulnerable, I was hurt, and most of all, I really just wanted the whole damn thing to go away, so I never reported it. And that night, that person I felt had power over me. And my way to take back my power was to park that experience in the far reaches in the back of my mind. And at the time, you know, as a teenager, that seemed like the best thing to do, the best way to move forward. I have since learned that that's often how people experiencing powerlessness, it's how they cope. And their silence is key to how the powerful can continue to dominate. So we're going to skip ahead to 2009. And that's when I came to a high school on the far south side of Chicago in Roseland. It's just a few blocks away, ironically, from the school that I attended for grammar school. And this time, I wasn't the student. Guess who I was? I was the principal. And Finger at that time was all too typical, or what we think of urban schools. It was a school that had many kids failing, and not just failing in terms of academics, but on their overall life outcomes. The situation was daunting. I really want you to hear these numbers. The graduation rate from the school, we had 1,400 kids at the time I arrived and my team arrived. The graduation rate was around 47%. The dropout rate was 20%. On average, we had an incoming class of ninth graders, roughly 300 to 400 kids, where 40% of them are reading at a third or a fourth grade reading level or below. We did have our non-readers. 60% of our young people were considered homeless. It was a place where all those things that we think about in terms of challenges within communities, really where the rubber met the road. So I'd like you to stand up for a moment. Don't stand up yet. I appreciate your participation. You were getting up. Thank you so much. She started to stand up. Thank you. So in a second, you're going to stand up. And I want you to do this activity because I want you to, sometimes we hear numbers, we don't really feel them. I want you to get a sense of like what we're talking about here. So I'm going to ask everybody in the room to stand on up. This is so good. I feel like I'm a principal again. This is like really good. Okay, so stand up. Stretch out. Feel good. Okay, so you're sitting in approximately tables of 10. I know there's not 10 every table, so don't get too caught up in this stuff because then it'll be just a, don't overthink it. I know you guys are really smart. Don't overthink it. Okay, so at each table, I want two of you, before we do this, everyone just actually look around the room. Just get a good scan of the room, kind of look, see the numbers, kind of what you're looking at. Okay. So, at each table, I want two people to sit down. There you go. Good job. We're following directions. Good. Okay. So, that's about how many kids at Finger were dropping out in any given year. Okay. Now, I want, we'll see if this hall works out. I want three more of you, two stay seated. I want three more of you to sit down. Well, this didn't work out quite how I planned. But, okay, everybody sit down. We tried it. But the gist is that there were a lot of kids dropping out, and we had a lot of kids not graduating. But this actually will work. Okay, so get a good sense of the room, look around. Okay, so can you guys hear me okay? Okay, so what I'd like to do is have, I think we've got roughly little over 600 or so people in the room. So get a good scan of the room. And then you guys on this side of the room, stay seated. And I want everybody on this side of the room to stand up. Okay. So that's roughly like 300 or so people. That's how many arrests were happening inside of the building in 1 year. Okay? You guys can sit back down. You're a good class. Thank you. So we're talking about a school where education was barely happening. Now, in this chapter of the story, I wasn't powerless. I was actually the one who was in power. I was the principal. And I felt that first and foremost, we had to establish rules, we had to establish order, and we had to establish consequences if you decided to violate those rules. Back then, I wasn't thinking about the Miss K's of the world. I didn't understand how important it was to be proximate to people, about the face-to-face human interaction that's actually critical to doing this type of work. I didn't understand how important it was to know someone's story, someone's why. And if I had known a Miss K, maybe I would have gotten successful a lot more quickly. Instead, though, and you guys can appreciate this, I just summoned my inner nun. We're going to have consequences. We're going to have structure. We're going to have a high school. That's what we're getting ready to do. So here's part of what I did. I figured out, okay, who's causing the most issues? Out of 1,400 kids, it was probably 75 that I felt were leading all the chaos in the school. So I went in to the school system, print out all their pictures, their basic information. I had a meeting with my leadership team. We brought in this huge whiteboard. I pasted their pictures up. We talked about every single student. And I told my team, these are the kids we're going for. These are the kids who are getting up out of finger. You document every single thing these children do, and we're getting up out of there. We're suspending them, and we're gonna keep suspending them, we're gonna keep pointing them out, and we're gonna expel them, and we're gonna have order in our school. We're gonna have order. And this seemed like a really good idea at the time. It seemed like a really good idea. Because I was putting everybody on notice. If you weren't here to learn, you were getting up out of here. But looking back, if I really honestly step back and look at this, I can see that all I was doing was labeling kids and reinforcing the system. I had the power, and therefore it led me to the mistake of thinking, because I had the power, well, I must have all the answers. That's what I must do. So we weren't getting to the root of why were those 75, why, what was going on with them, why were they quote unquote acting up? And as a result, I'm afraid we weren't doing any justice work at Finger when we first started. All we were doing was stigmatizing our children and furthering this sense of hopelessness that permeated the walls of our school. And I believe that shifting power, doing justice work, it's a contact sport. So fast forward, I founded an organization, Chicago Beyond, about 3 years ago, and I'll talk to you about Chicago Beyond in a second, but at Chicago Beyond, it's a contact sport. It's what we're committed to. So we broke it down into seven pieces, and these are seven common ways we, the powerful, I would argue everyone in this room has power, those with privilege hold power in place. And to kind of illustrate this, I want to put it in the context of Fanger, because my high school, because I feel like you guys were all on that journey with me. You stood up, you sat down, you laughed. You were to put it in the context of Fanger. So let me share how, when I came to Fanger, we showed up against these seven. God bless you. You're welcome. Tawa, hey. Oh my God. God bless you. Okay. I know her. Okay. Okay, so let me share how when I came to Fanger, we showed up against these seven clear and specific tests of whether we're serious about the collective work of justice. And here they are, and there are some missteps. I'm gonna talk through some missteps I made with each of these seven. So the first one is access. When I started as a principal, there was no question about who had a seat at the table, because guess what? I was the entire table. And perhaps I gave one or two people some honorary access, but not really, if I'm being honest with you, not really. I had the power, and I was making the decisions, the real decisions that matter. And I really didn't care what anyone else had to say. The second, information. The information we looked at for students. Now keep in mind the trauma that must have been happening to have that many arrests, that many things going on in the building. The information we used to make decisions, you want to know what it was only? It was kids' grades. Have you been suspended? Have you been arrested? Have you had any altercations with teachers? We looked at information about children. This was our basic framework was, what is wrong with you? Not what has happened to you. That's how we looked at things. Next up, validity. There's something that's so vulnerable about telling all the things where you messed up, but this, I think it's so important. Next up is validity. So I had three members of my leadership team. The first person, no particular order, was Ms. T. And in my eyes, she had validity and her voice had validity because she was a school counselor. And so she was valid in my mind. Next up was the data guru. He was the other member of the leadership team. And he had validity in my eyes because he had an Ivy League degree. He was great with data. And he asked these really profound questions when we looked at data. So I had deemed that he was valid too. And then there was the other member of my leadership team, Mr. M, who, to be honest, if I'm really honest, I feel embarrassed to say it, I really took him less seriously. And I took him less seriously because he didn't have the characteristics I deemed to be relevant in terms of how to turn our school around. And he looked less like the valid sources of evidence and information I had learned to take seriously in my training as a principal. Next up is ownership. And as you might imagine, the people in power, the leaders took ownership. The rest of the school, not so much. And this was a biggie. It's one of the biggest lessons I learned at Fanger, and we've embedded into the DNA of who we are at Chicago Beyond, is about letting go of power and really leaning into shared ownership and shared power. Next up is value. At first, I tried to maintain the traditional school system in our school. It was about suspensions, it was about expulsions, it was about order, it was get in line with this program. Not having any risks, not trying any new ideas, going exactly as the school system would require us to go. So I was all about those rules that served to just maintain the status quo. And the status quo, as you can imagine, was clearly failing. So I came to realize that in order to build value, risk actually was required. Now, I think you all can relate to this next one. It's accountability. Now, if we're really being honest, one of the favorite habits of the powerful is to hold people accountable. We love to hold people accountable. We do. Without focusing on actually being accountable ourselves, we love to do that. We get spreadsheets on it and checklists and questions we'd like to ask and hold people accountable. At the beginning, we made this mistake too at Fanger. And eventually we shifted, right? And then we instituted a peer jury mechanism where kids were responsible, where kids owned and were held accountable for one another. Sure enough, they started to see that they too had power. And through the relationships my team and I were building among us with parents and students, we, as the adults, started to be held accountable too. And finally, this is such a powerful one, there's authorship. This is about the power to author our own story. Our kids felt like their stories were always being told by others. For example, one day I had a student stop me in the hallway, like right outside the main office. It was a young lady. And she stopped me, and she had this little kind of cutout, if you can imagine. You know those newspaper cartoons, kind of like in the Tribune or sometimes? She had cut out this little cartoon from the Chicago Tribune, and she hands it to me. And she's like, look at this, Miss Dozier, and this is what she showed me. Now, this was around the time that Chicago was making a bid for the Olympics. And if you have trouble reading it, I'll read it to you so you can hear what it says. It says, the top, wait till the International Olympic Committee sees what we have to offer. And on the bottom right, it shows kids attacking and beating another kid outside of the image of a school that has a sign finger. And it was a reference to the violence that plagued our community. This was the story that the people in power were telling about our children to the masses. This was like ice water thrown in my face. And clearly, it was time for us, for our children to tell and to author their own stories. And so at Fenger, we started to tell a new story. And this story had no secret sauce, but it had a new framework. And it was a framework of restorative justice. This dramatically shifted how we viewed our duties and how we designed the ecosystem in which our kids existed. Steadily, our approach to access, to information, to validity, ownership, value, accountability, and authorship completely changed as our new story began to unfold. We became aware of our own bias, and we became aware of our own assumptions, and we started with the commitment to find another way to relate to one another, another way that goes beyond numbers, to really understand the human beings that we were charged with serving. And so we built a lot bigger table, with a lot more seats, and we had regular meetings, regular things that included your unusual suspects. And so that for us meant really tapping into adults in the building who the kids had relationships with. Sometimes that meant the janitor. Kids build relationships with a whole bunch of people. Sometimes it meant the baseball coach. It was all people who had real knowledge about our kids, despite whatever their title might be. So we changed the information that we welcomed into the system and what we considered to be valid. So we would have these weekly meetings with 20 people across the school, right? And they included your usual suspects, some counselors, some teachers kids had relationships with, but also include that baseball coach, that janitor, that lunchroom lady, the person who worked in the main office, people who had relationships about kids, and we began to share information and plan together on how to serve that same 75 I talked about, but to really truly serve them in authentic ways that, again, ask the question of not what is wrong with you, but what's happened to you, and how can we do something better? And Mr. M, that person I told you about on my leadership team, over time, everyone on our leadership team and in our school began to recognize how deeply valuable his relationships were with our students. For many of our kids, especially when we first got there as a team, it didn't matter what your title was. You could be the principal or you could be the police. It didn't matter. It didn't matter. But it mattered what Mr. M thought. Because Mr. M had relationships with our students. He knew their families. He knew kids' birthdays. He knew whose uncle had died. He knew what made people really feel seen. And we all began to take his lead, not just on decisions in terms of things to do with young people from a point of data, but ultimately we began to make decisions based on relationship and in deeper knowledge. So we built on those relationships from Fenger, and just as we are now building on relationships at Chicago Beyond today with our nonprofit partners. And we build when we, and this is the we in the room, right? Wherever you sit in your work, when we begin to build relationship, we show up differently. And at a school, when we as the adults began to show up differently, guess who else shows up differently? The kids, you're right. So these relationships led to a fundamental truth that if we wanted Fenger to be a place of learning, it first had to become a place of safety, and not just physical safety. Yes, we did the exercise, and you saw that basically this whole side of the room was a number of people that got arrested, right? So yes, there was physical safety, but it was also about building a place of emotional safety for our young people. Our kids lived in complex, often traumatic and unsafe ecosystem. It was on the streets, and far too often, in our case, it was often in their homes. So our school at Fanger needed to be a refuge. So to achieve this transformation, we did a whole bunch of things, right, big and small. And I don't have enough time to go through all of it, so I won't. I'll give you a couple of nuggets here, and in no particular order. We began to just like spruce up the school. Do you know what I'm saying? To make it a school, whether it was with paint or pictures that were culturally relevant and posters. There were all type of touches to make the school physically brighter, to show that we actually, as a community, cared, to make it a welcoming place. We hired as many male teachers as humanly possible. We put in serious academic interventions. I'll just go a little bit off script here. But like there was this thing when we came, I told you about the reading scores with kids, right? And you know, when you go to high school, you're in English 101. And so when you're in English 101, you guys remember English 101, there's certain books you're reading, right? Certain kind of curriculum. And we had to step back and say, okay, like I understand that Chicago Public Schools has this sequence of how we should, you know, be doing school. But if a child can't read, what the heck are they doing in English 101? But there was a push from the district on this, right? About you can't just put kids in reading classes, how do we give them credit? But we did. We completely reframed for those children who struggled what to do with those classes. We put in place serious academic interventions. We also had teachers visit students' homes outside of the school day. We put teachers in the community to help understand our students from a different perspective. We instituted things like grief counseling and anger management, things that people don't typically think of in a school day. Those were in our school day. And we instituted an entirely restorative justice-based approach to just how we ran the school, not even to discipline, but to how we ran the school. That meant peace circles, it meant peer juries, it just meant a whole wealth of resources that were framed in restorative justice. We did for our kids at Fanger what you would want somebody to do for your kids, for your own biological children. Well, it worked, and again, I don't have time to go into all the stuff. There's a lot more that we did. But once we changed the school environment and our relationship with people, we were able to see who our kids really were, because guess what? They showed up as who they really were. And this is when I got to the power of our young people and their resilience. But it was also when our kids just started to blossom. So during our team's first, which are 6 years at Fanger, our graduation rates, our state graduation rates, rose from about 47% to over 80%. The dropout rate fell from around, it was 20% to down below 2%. Those arrests that were once 300 per year were now down below 10. 40%, oh, thank you. 40% of our seniors graduated with a college credential, or I'm sorry, career credential or a college credit, which let me tell you was no easy feat. But they did that. And the trends have continued since I left. In 2017 and 2018, 100% of Fanger seniors have gone on to get accepted to college. And that's every single senior moving into an institution of higher learning. And it's not rocket science in a lot of ways, right? It's all about how the powerful, in this case, myself, my leadership team, listened to those who were technically powerless. And as a result, the kids were able to discover what it was like to experience justice in their own lives. So we're gonna pause there. And I want you to, I'm totally putting on my teacher principal thing right now, so we're gonna pause here. And you heard a little bit about how I use my own power in relationship to Fanger and how I use that power to uphold systems that were not the best for children. And so I want you to take the next 2 minutes, and I'm going to time it. You're not going to talk to your neighbors. No talking to your neighbors. Let's do some silent reflection. And I want you to think about this question. In what ways do you hold up power that can be unhealthy for others? So it's just a silent reflection. We're not talking, we're not moving. Silent reflection, you can go ahead and go. You got 2 minutes, no talking. So we'll pause there. We're not going to share with our neighbors. It was just an opportunity for you to reflect. And I think it's always important to reflect on our own power and privilege because it impacts others. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about Chicago Beyond, which we have spent, those people that you saw at the beginning, we've spent the last 3 years founding and building together. There's 16 of us now on the Chicago Beyond team. So by the time we launched Chicago Beyond, I had known what it felt like to be utterly powerless and what it was like to have power over others. I had seen the results when I based my decisions on myself and kind of what I felt should happen. And also when I based my decisions on what was much better, which was listening to stakeholders, really having people at the table, listening to voice. And I had experienced the deep gratification that comes from being part of a collective effort to move an unjust system towards justice. These were the sensibilities I brought to my new job at Chicago Beyond. I wanted Chicago Beyond to truly go beyond being just another charity. It wasn't about charity. I wanted it to be, and I still to this day, I want to be a model for justice for young people who have grown up thinking the world just didn't apply to them. So to this end, Chicago Beyond's basic MO is this. We provide transformative funding and people power to organizations that are working at the grassroots level and also at the systems level. So those two ends of the spectrum is where we focus our work. Chicago Beyond decided to consciously work at both ends of the spectrum. And we don't just write a check. Actually, the check is the least interesting thing that Chicago Beyond does. It is really about the team that you saw kind of that stood up at the beginning. It's about them on the ground with our nonprofit partners. And it is about helping them build out whatever it is, their strategy, their infrastructure, being a thought partner, and not some thought partner on high where they can only tell us what the compliance checklist says they should do, but really partner and grapple with ideas and help them build and grow. And it's not always pretty, and it doesn't always follow some linear line. It is often complicated. In our first 3 years, we have committed over $30 million to 14 nonprofits in Chicago and one leader in residence. But more important about the funding, it is the how we do our work. And I know this is what distinguishes us. I wanted to take Chicago Beyond. I want to take everything that I had learned at Fanger and I wanted to push it farther. How do we think about those same seven in the context of a city? How can we as a team go further in checking our own biases? How could we as an organization root ourselves in relationships with our nonprofit partners from the very start? How could we tackle those inequities that show up in the work that we do, from access, information, validity, ownership, value, accountability, and authorship? How could we at Chicago Beyond push ourselves to be out of business? And everything we do at Chicago Beyond starts with our own internal work. It's like the reflection that you just did. We have members of our team who are leading our own internal work on our own bias. We talk about our own bias all the time, because guess what? We all show up with it. We do work on like race, understanding privilege, and we talk openly about race, which as individuals we do, and also what we do as a general organization. We believe this is the strongest work that we can do as an organization to decondition injustice. And just like at Fanger, we're experimenting in Chicago Beyond, and we know, and I would challenge you to think about this, we know that if we aren't uncomfortable, that we aren't making mistakes and we aren't learning and we aren't actually doing what we set out to do. So we started asking ourselves a lot of how can we? And like at Fanger, we're learning from our missteps. So let me give you some other embarrassing examples to kind of put it in context of our work and shifting power and doing examples of our justice work. And not embarrassing in the traditional sense, it's just more of like, it's really about how do we put out our vulnerabilities to say that this work is not easy and it's not pretty and it can be really, really messy. And I would argue if everything in your organization is just flying, just going nice and smoothly, How are you really challenging yourself? How are you really supporting organizations in their work? So let me give you a few examples of how this looks like in practice. And you know, confession, it's a big room. We have a lot of ups and downs. Like, it is what it is. So example number one really has to do, and we talked to our nonprofit partner about this. So I think we're getting ready to say we've talked them about, so have no fear. So we partnered with an organization last year, Lawndale Christian Legal Center, and we were so proud to partner with them. And Lawndale Christian Legal Center, if you don't know them, they're on the west side of Chicago in the Lawndale community, and they provide holistic legal services and assistance to young people. And it's not just about a defense attorney. It's not just about, you know, getting legal representation. It's really about healing. It's about stable relationships. And so if that young person has issues with housing, with unemployment, then they need counseling, they need substance abuse treatment, mental health services, general wellness services, Lawndale Christian Legal helps link them to those services and provides them support in a holistic way so that our kids, their kids, can have a true shot at achieving their potential. So we decided to partner together. We were so excited to partner with them. We invested $1.6 million into Lawndale Christian Legal Center. And the idea is that, you know, we would help them expand. We would provide them the strategic support to open another site. We would help them think about their model and how to do their model better. All things that they had wanted to do. So we were excited. We spent 4 to 5 months planning around this. And then part of what Lawndale Christian Legal Center wanted to do, they said, hey, what we really want to do is, like, we think our model is actually a better model for justice. If you actually have people who are charged with a crime, who are in the legal system, the better way to do this model is to actually not just give people a public defender who sees them for 30 seconds or 60 seconds here and there, but real defense, and then provide them with all the things that could potentially get in the way of them being successful. Housing insecurity, food insecurity, substance abuse, like, it makes sense. And we think it's better than the public defender's model. And so we spent all this time, we worked with the public defender, Amy Campanelli and her team, and we agreed to do this incredible research study to prove, like, actually, Lawndale Christian Legal Center's model is actually a better model in terms of recidivism and a whole bunch of other characteristics than the public defender's model. We're proud of Chicago Beyond to support that. They were excited to support it, Lawndale Christian Legal Center, in terms of their leadership team. The public defender was excited. We're all excited. 4 to 5 months of planning. It went right along with their vision for systemic change. Everyone's excited. Then we get a call from the executive leadership team. And they said, you know, we're just not sure we can proceed with a partnership. Hello? Like, we've, you know, committed almost 2 million, like, what's going on? And their response was that, you know, we're having some problems. Like, we're now getting ready to enter in this study, and members of our team, counselors, attorneys, caseworkers, are concerned, like, what does this actually mean? They were skeptical about who Chicago Beyond was, and they were concerned what strings might be attached to the money. Makes sense, right? 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 It makes sense. Now, when I told this story to somebody a while back, they were like, well, what'd you do? What happened? And basically, after some reflection, we decided as a team, we worked with the executive team at Lawndale Christian Legal, and we said, okay, they're a big restorative justice proponents. And we said to them, let's have a peace circle. We'll bring out members of Chicago Beyond's team. We'll have the members of Lawndale Christian Legal there, all their case managers, attorneys, and we'll sit down and we'll have a peace circle. And the person I told the story to was like, you're about to give them $1.6 million, and you're gonna have a peace circle to make them feel comfortable? Like, what in the name of the word is happening? You don't owe them anything. They should be grateful. But where does that sense of gratitude come from? It comes from this notion of charity. Like, they should be grateful. But no, it's not about gratitude and about charity. It is about fundamental justice work. And in fundamental justice work, we're all equal. And so our partners have an issue. Okay, we're all equal. We're no better than they are. They're no better than us. Let's sit down in a circle. And so we went out there, myself, 3 members of my team, and we sat down and we had a peace circle. and they asked us some tough questions, and we asked them some tough questions. At the end, after that hour plus long peace circle, when everybody had a voice, we came to a conclusion that we would still partner. They understood a little better who we were, and we understood them better. And that's what a peace circle is about, and that's what equity is all about. No one has more or less power in a circle. No one has more or less power in a relationship. We were all joined in this idea of justice, this common cause. The second example I'll give to you is we partnered with an organization called Iman. Is Shamar here? Shamar, are you still here? There you are. That's Shamar. Shamar is works at Iman. One of my all-time favorite kids, who I just love so much, died on March 20th of 2017. And he was shot and killed at 3:30 in the afternoon on March 20th. And his friend, who you see on the left, that's Savon, was in some imminent danger with his life. The same thing that happened to Jason was threatened. Savon was one of those same threats. And we didn't know, we kind of talked with a couple other partners over at Chicago Cred, if you know Chicago Cred, and we're trying to figure out, okay, what do we do with Savon? Like, where does he go? So we searched like national models, like who has a model? What do you do with young people who are in serious crisis? You just can't, like, what do you do? And ultimately, there was no model out there. And Chicago Cred led us to the work at Iman that Rami Nashashibi is leading the whole team over in Iman, Shamar, Billy, Belial. And collectively with Iman, our organization saw the urgency behind it. We didn't say, like, okay, well, what's the data say we should do? And how do we think about metrics? And what is it? But it was really about answering the call, answering the need of the people that we serve, treating people like human beings and like family. And so with the support of Iman and Chicago Beyond, we built the Youth Leadership Home. And it is a safe haven and a home for our young people. We didn't have the perfect plan. We're still working on building it out, but it exists. It is where our young men can go and be safe. The third example I'll give to you is that we've asked ourselves at Chicago Beyond, how can we truly drive systemic change? We know that our kids in Chicago face trauma just by the very existence of them going from point A to point B, from going from their homes to school, just existing. And so for us, we know that it was important to address that. And so we thought, how can we do it through really supporting a leader with a big vision for healing communities without knowing at the start exactly what the support would look like or what would happen? And that's the kind of long-term, open-ended support that isn't the norm in the funding world, but is how we have built our leadership venture, which is led by Nika Jones Tapia. If you know Nika Jones Tapia's work, you know that she led the Cook County Jail, which is the second largest jail in the country. And she did phenomenal work on reducing the population of those who were incarcerated with mental health and wellness. She built a whole mental health transition center. Her reputation is just incredible, the work that she's done. And so we hired that woman you see on the screen, and we didn't have a plan laid out with 18,000 metrics and everything like perfectly pitched, but we believed in her and her abilities and gave her the ability to run. And now, Nika, Chicago Beyond, we are partnering with Chicago Public Schools to build out an entire trauma-based framework for all of Chicago Public Schools. In these examples, I've only discussed the power dynamic that is inherent in the relationship between funders and nonprofits. But the power dynamic in the philanthropic world is actually a triad, and many of you have seen this. In addition to funders and nonprofits, there's a third wielder of power, and it's the less obvious, but it has great power. Anybody can guess who I'm talking about? What group? Researchers. Now we're getting ready to get into something. Okay. So I'm talking about researchers. The bottom line is that the triad is perceived to not be made up of equals. It gives the most power to funders and researchers, with the least power ending up where it also does in society, with those who are doing the work, those who are technically perceived to be without. Researchers have enormous influence, in part because they are theoretically, let me underline the word theoretically a neutral and unbiased party. Our premise is that since evidence matters, and we know evidence matters because it drives decision making, we must care how the evidence is made. Justice in knowledge, it turns out, must precede social justice. I'm gonna say it again. Justice in knowledge, it turns out, must precede social justice. With this in mind, we at Chicago Beyond, with our partners, have explored this dynamic between funders, nonprofits, and researchers in depth, and have just published a guidebook titled, Why Am I Always Being Researched? So this is what it looks like. Also a helpful thing. You can see it on the screen what it looks like. So yes, there's a little bit of irony in publishing a research guidebook about the problems of research. Okay? But that's really the point. There's nothing inherently wrong with research, for that matter, philanthropy, but there is a problem. Here's where the problem is, how we're practicing both of these pursuits. This guidebook aspires to provide a meaningful and practical step towards correcting what isn't working. And the irony in all of it, and I hope you all see it, is that Chicago Beyond has the privilege and the power to put it out into the world. Right? I mean, that's true. We have the privilege and the power to do it. But these ideas that you see that exist in this guidebook are ideas, they are feelings, they are knowledge that have existed in communities and across our country for decades. There were hundreds of people from the funding world, from some of the most, the quote unquote, best research institutions across our country, nonprofit partners who helped us put all of this together. At your tables, you've got a little pocket-sized one, so you'll have this. This is yours. It's a little excerpt, and we hope that our guidebook can serve as a practical toolkit. It's organized in three main sections, the actual guidebook, which you can find on our website at chicagobeyond.org. And it's organized into those three sections, one for community, one for researchers, and one for funders. We tailor our findings and recommendations for each member of the philanthropic triad. But more importantly, it is completely transparent with everyone able to see and share all the data. So you can get the copy at our website. In research two, access, information, validity, ownership, value, accountability, authorship provides 7 clear and specific tests of whether we are serious about the collective work of justice. And I truly believe if you're in this forum today, that you do believe in justice. You just do. I have spoken at great length about this power imbalance in American philanthropy. Well, you know what? Most of us in this room, including myself, are on the side of power. So if we are serious about bringing a more equitable system, then I would argue, just like Ms. Karen, we have to give up a little bit of our power. And this is how we can truly achieve collective impact, what we're all here to do today. This is how we move towards justice. But the fact is that giving up power is not what most human beings like to do. We just don't like to do it. So holding on to power, it's almost like in our genes, it's how we're raised. It's how the fittest survive. However, I think there's an elegant solution. And I don't think of it as giving up power. I think of it as using our power to empower others. If we can adopt this mentality, then real change will happen. Otherwise, the existing power structures will continue to replicate themselves again and again. So take a look at the screen. You're going to see some questions. We're not going to stay here. But let's look at those questions. How do you show up? What are the things you need to question? And again, there are no right answers, right? How do you share your access to your resources and decision making? How do you hold yourself accountable while still holding others accountable? How can you restore authorship to the communities that you serve? How do you build real relationships? Not where people have to come to you and they have to show you all the pretty things that they've done, but how do you really build authorship? How are you disrupting in your field? And again, there are no right answers, but I believe there are right questions to get us on the road to constructive disruption. And it really does come down to the title of this conference. It's about collective impact. Our society is not going to progress because of the acts of any one individual. It just doesn't. Finger didn't progress just because of me. It was a collection of us. It's not about any one group. It's not about any one sector or one philanthropic or one community agency. It will only progress if we act collectively, similar to the work that Chicago Beyond has done with Iman. And collective action is only possible where there is shared, true shared power, not the seat at the table as an honorary seat that has no power. Imagine a place. Imagine a world where people like Ms. K, who I talked about early, aren't just lone individuals with these acts of kindness, but they are members of society that makes it clear that they are valued and what they do is actually impactful. This would be transformative. Well, the Ms. K's are out there, they're quietly doing their good works. It is our work to connect with them, and it's our responsibility to help empower them, which brings me back to where I began. There is a word in the English language that is all about shared power, and that word is justice. And I'm reminded of the words of Bryan Stevenson, who was the director of the Equal Justice Initiative, which has come to the aid of dozens of men who are on death row, who were wrongfully convicted. And he says this, I'm sure you've heard this quote if you know of Bryan Stevenson. He says, the opposite of poverty is not wealth. The opposite of poverty isn't wealth. The opposite of poverty is justice. And I would only add that the way to combat poverty is not with charity. The way to combat poverty is with justice. Today I've shared my own journey and kind of what brought me to this point. You've all had your own journeys. Everyone's walked their own journey and that have brought you to the realization that we need collective action. And so I say to you, my fellow actors, let us collectively take the next step to use our power to empower. Use your power to empower. It's easy to sit back and be comfortable. Use your power to empower. And this will take us from charity to justice. And this will take us closer to our ultimate goal, the day when justice is truly the norm in our society and when we have put ourselves out of business. Thank you.
And this closes out this episode of the Collective Impact Forum podcast. If you're interested in learning more about Liz Dozier and Chicago Beyond's work, we've included information in the footnotes for this episode. The intro music for this episode was composed by Raphael Crooks, and our outro music is composed by Kevin McLeod. Please stay tuned for our next episode, and if you're looking for more resources, discussions, and news related to Collective Impact, please visit our online community at collectiveimpactforum.org. And for those interested in joining us for our next in-person learning event, registration is open for our 2020 Collective Impact Convening that will be in Minneapolis this May 6th through 8th, 2020. Thanks for listening, and until next time.